Shalom, I'm Chris. Let's follow Jesus along the Talmudim way. Deuteronomy chapter 1, also known as the Gospel according to Moses. As we said in our intro video, there's just not a lot of narrative in the book of Deuteronomy. It's a set of Moses' teachings. He's preaching, he's exhorting, challenging, but not really a lot of just step-by-step went here, went there. He's going to do some of that in this chapter, just kind of recapping where they've been, but the bulk of the book is just going to be his teachings. With other studies, I've had a PowerPoint file from Dr. Bolin from the Master Seminary out in California, and he's had a set of pictures and maps that go verse by verse through many books of the Bible, but unfortunately, he doesn't have a set for Deuteronomy, so we're going to have to change things up here. If you're watching the video, the slides are primarily going to be the chapter verses and then cross references that I've found and pulled in. I'll have the chapter verses in our typical blue, but to differentiate, the cross references will be in red. And I will intersperse pictures and maps wherever I can find them. We do have an audio version of this now. It's a podcast, and I'll include the link as I send the video out. So for this one, you know, either audio or video will work just as well. If you want to listen to the audio and follow along that way, that would work too. And you wouldn't be missing a whole lot because it's primarily just going to be text. One thing that's not changing, though, is our commitment to Acts 17:11 and James 1:22. So, Father, we ask you to bless our study. Have us be Bereans who receive the word with all eagerness, but who examine the scriptures daily to see whether these things be so. By this teaching, enable each of us to be doers of your word and not hearers only. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Deuteronomy 1, verse 1. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel. The name of the book in Hebrew is Devarim, and that comes from the first phrase, Elah ha-Devarim, and it's a catch-all word. It means words, matters, things. These are the things that Moses spoke. Words works just as well. So we've got that, and we talked a little bit about how we came up with the term Deuteronomy on our intro video, so if you want to go check that out, there it is. Moses is a type of Jesus speaking. So when we see Moses, we need to kind of picture him, except when he's sinning, he would be a type of Jesus. So all Israel, you can imagine him on the shores of the Jordan speaking to the whole camp, and they're physically and spiritually present to hear him. It reminds us of several episodes of Jesus' life, including the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus really emulated Moses by imparting God's standards to God's people with authority, and Moses has that same authority here. The people could not expect to hear but not do Moses' words and have any kind of fruitful life. And it's the same with us. We can't be hearers only. We must be hearers and doers. So if we're following Moses' words, he's going to challenge them to be doers. Don't just accept it, but be live it out with your life. We aren't really sure where the places listed in verse 1 take place, but we know it's somewhere opposite Jericho. I'll just go ahead and read it. These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel across the Jordan, in the wilderness, in the Arabah, opposite Suf, between Paran and Tophel, Laban, Hazeroth, and Dizahab. The way the topography works, any rainfall is going to be on the west side of the mountain. So if you're in what is modern Israel, Palestine, the rain's always going to fall to the west. There's the east side of the mountain is going to be very dry. Then you cross the Jordan and you have the same type of setup on the Jordanian side. So water is always going to fall to the west side. And that's where they are in this. They're on the east side of the Jordan, but on the west side of the mountain, if that makes sense. From a reference that comes later to the 11th month, we believe this is February or March. And so while the civil year begins in October, the religious year began in the March or April. So in the summer, this region will get blazing hot and super dry. But in February, it's going to be comfortable, 70s or 80s, and they will have some water rolling off the mountain. The phrase across the Jordan is evidence that we had some kind of editor writing from the perspective of someone already in the land. So we talked about this again in the intro video. Moses, you know, we believe this is the words of Moses. These are the words of Moses, but there's clearly an editor in play, tidying up here and there and inserting references as we go along. If you know the book, My Utmost for His Highest, we say it's by Oswald Chambers. He actually didn't write that book. It was his wife that compiled it and put it together. together under his name. So same type of idea. As we said in the intro video, this location on the east side of the Jordan, exactly opposite Jericho, is the same location where Elijah ascended, and it's the same location where John the Baptist was preaching, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." And so in Deuteronomy, Moses is going to preach repentance just as John did. The kingdom is at hand, and they're about to inherit. Verse 2, it is an 11 days journey from Horeb by the way of Mount Seir to Kadesh Barnea. And this is a photo you see of Kadesh Barnea. Horeb is, in Deuteronomy, it's the name for Mount Sinai. So whenever you see Horeb, you can think Mount Sinai. So in other words, this journey should have taken 11 days to inherit, but it took 40 years. And we'll get into why as this chapter unfolds. Verse 3, in the 40th year, on the first day of the 11th month, Moses spoke to the sons of Israel in accordance with everything that the Lord had commanded him to declare to them, after he defeated Sihon, the king of the Amorites, who lived in Heshbon, and Og, the king of Bashan, who lived in Ashtaroth and Edrei. And these events are recorded in Numbers 21. Again, all of these are territories on the east side of the Jordan. The section of the map that's on the left-hand side would be towards the south, sort of not too far from where they are now by the camp. And then way up the right side of the map is up north in Bashan, heading towards the region of Caesarea Philippi. Across the Jordan in the land of Moab, so we have that emphasized twice, which is interesting, Moses began to explain this law, saying, and then it goes on. As we mentioned again in that intro video, law is not really the best translation. The word is Torah, but unfortunately using the term law has colored Christianity's view of the Hebrew Bible for millennia. And the more I dig into it, the more I think it was a ploy by Satan in order to keep people away from God's word. And it has definitely done that. The word Torah is closer to the meaning for teaching. And there's a Greek word called didache that's actually much better than nomos, which is the word for law. Dennis Prager has a commentary on Deuteronomy, believe it or not, and he writes, "Just about every aspect of life, religion, morality, happiness, anger, judgment, is contained in Deuteronomy, and it's the most important document of the Bible, the Ten Commandments, is repeated here." So this is going to be all about teaching and exhorting, and we're going to see that Moses' intent was to be a teacher. In fact, if you ask Moses what he thought he was doing, he would probably say teaching or even preaching. He would never say that he was a lawyer or a legislator. So we need to, as much as we can, remove our thought that the first five books, at least the four books after Genesis, are just about a series of do's and don'ts. They're much more than that. Deuteronomy 4, listen to what I am teaching you so that you will live. Deuteronomy 6, your God has commanded me to teach you. And so it goes on, so that you may do them in the land. So begin being doers of the word. Even when he is providing a recap of the law, Moses treats it more like a pastor. So he's going to have exposition, encouragement, exhortation, exactly like a pastor would. And that's why we can call it the Gospel according to Moses, because it's full of teaching. One of the dangers of the law is that what Moses is talking about is not legalistic obedience, but this whole context of this book is how should we respond to the undeserved love shown by God. And that's what Paul calls a circumcised heart in Romans 2. Circumcision is of the heart by the Spirit, not by the letter. So probably another ploy of Satan is to get God's people thinking that they need just to do keep a series of do's and don'ts, and then we'll be okay. And of course, we can see that in Judaism, but we also see it in Christianity. Ask the average Christian how they get to heaven, and even though they may know about Jesus, their answer is probably going to be, "I'll be a good person, and I'll be let in, and my good will outweigh the bad," and that kind of thing. Of course, that's entirely wrong. It's got to be a heart move, and it's a gift of thanks back towards God who does so much for us. Even Paul later in 2 Timothy says all scripture is inspired by God, beneficial for teaching, rebuke, correction, training in righteousness, so that the man or woman may be fully capable, equipped for every good work. And so Paul was likely speaking of Deuteronomy when he said this. So these teachings, including but not limited to those do's and don'ts, are to be our guide for living in the community. And they were to be their guide for living in the community in their land, and they're our guide today for living amongst each other. Verse 6, the Lord our God spoke to us at Horeb, that's Mount Sinai, saying, you have stayed long enough at this mountain. So Moses goes into this recap of how they got here. He's going to, in one chapter, cover 40 years worth of time, including a major failure that the first generation had that we'll get to. So the sermon can be divided up into three sections. So chapter 1 is going to be recollections of the Lord's grace in calling that first generation, and we'll see how they failed. He will later preach in chapter 2 about the Lord's grace in calling the current generation, in chapters 2 and 3. And then chapter 4 will deal about the future generations, what you're supposed to do to, you know, pass this on and keep the gifts going. The first five verses of Deuteronomy 1 were really an introduction. Verse 6 begins this historical prologue. And we've talked in the background, or in the first video, about how Deuteronomy is set out like a treaty, a suzerain vassal treaty. And so the first part always starts with this historical prologue, what the king has done and how it came about that he is entering into this treaty with the vassal. And in a typical treaty, it would say how great the king is and why you owe your allegiance. But you know, God's going to do the same thing here, or through Moses. He's going to remind them how they came to be sitting here on the plains of Moab, about ready to inherit the land. Verse 7 we looked at in the intro video. Turn and set your journey to go to the hill country of the Amorites and to all their neighbors in the Arabah, in the hill country, in the lowland, and the word for that is Shephelah, in the Negev, by the seacoast, by the land of the Canaanites, and Lebanon as far as the great river Euphrates. And again, this verse is just absolutely fascinating to me because we have the precise geographic and even geologic locations of the regions in the land. So the Transjordan would be the hill country of the Amorites. The Jordan Valley would be the Arabah, the Rift, Jordan Rift Valley. We have the hill country of Judea and Samaria, the Shephelah, that lowland. And of course, your perspective, if you're calling something low, and this is the perspective of someone who's already in the hill country. So another nod to maybe an editor there. The biblical Negev is in the south, and then the coastal plains, which is where the Philistines were the lowest, you know, sea level area, and the furthest west of the country. See, I have placed the land before you. Go in and take possession of the land which the Lord swore to give to your fathers, Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob, and their descendants after them. The land that God is giving them, we talked about this before too, is strategically located at the crossroads, really, of the known world at that point. So if you're in Egypt and you wanted to get to Mesopotamia or Europe, you had to go through this land. If you're in Mesopotamia, you want to get to Egypt, you didn't just cross the desert because you couldn't do that. So you had to turn around and go through the Holy Land. So the land is too hilly. It doesn't lend itself to being a world empire. There's not enough water to be a world-dominating empire. But as we talked about, they're not supposed to be world-dominating. They're supposed to be world-influencing. And that is, boy, if that doesn't describe the church. It's not supposed to be about political and temporal power. We've seen mistakes made along those lines throughout history. But we are to be influencing. We're to be that light to the nations, as Isaiah says in 49. Verse 6, he says, is it too small a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob, to restore the protected ones of Israel? I will also make you a light of the nations, so that my salvation may reach the ends of the earth. That was the goal. If you look back at that previous map, that's what people were passing by. They were supposed to say, look at the Israelites and say, hey, you're different. Your concept of justice is way different than ours. You have a temple with nothing in it, no idols or anything. That's very different from the other parts in that world. So with this strategic location, it's clear that God wanted them to be an influence on those passing through. Many passages in the prophets have this dual reference. So in the immediate context, it's the nation or the people of Israel. But in an extended context, this passage is also about Messiah, who's a light to the nations also. And from this, we see that Messiah and the land are connected. And why going to Israel is so powerful is because you're getting closer to Jesus because of that connection between Messiah and the Lamb. Verse 9, and I spoke to you at that time, saying, I'm not able to endure you alone. The Lord your God has multiplied you, and behold, you are this day like the stars of heaven in number. Notice how Moses speaks to the second generation as if they were there in the first generation. Now, the people he's talking to in Deuteronomy 1 were, this is, you know, 40 years ago. So at most they were 20. Maybe they were like 5 and 6 years old at this time. They didn't have anything to do with causing strife or causing Moses any headaches. It was their parents who were the problem, right? Yet in that Middle Eastern mindset that we talked about earlier, people are directly connected to the past as if they were there. And that's just a foreign thought for us. We're always looking forward. We mentioned before that Jews who observe Passover, they talk as if they were the ones leaving Egypt all those years ago. And it's a great perspective to have as we dive into this book, and we'll have more to say as we conclude the study. So the reference here, what Moses is talking about is a fulfillment of Genesis 15:5 and the promise to make the offspring more like the stars more than the stars in the heaven. And now we don't need to take this hyper literally, right? There's not going to be one person for every single star. The point of the promise was to say to the childless Abraham, he won't even be able to imagine the future number of offspring because, again, the past, the future, present, they're all connected. His promises to Abraham will continue long after he's passed from the earth. And again, that's another good perspective to have. This life is just but a speck in time. And our souls, and our resurrection bodies will continue forever. We talked about earlier this being a transition book. So the promises made to Abraham were not fulfilled in his lifetime, but they were about to be fulfilled here. Even though he may not have seen it, and they struggled with difficulties, and they felt that God was unfaithful in his promises, right? This is chapter 15. Genesis 16 is what? That's Abraham and Hagar, that whole scene there. So he doubted there, and he felt that God didn't see him, just as the people were feeling that maybe in that day. God doesn't see us because too much time has passed. I'm tired of waiting. And of course, it's not true. And it's not true when we feel that God doesn't see us, even though we may feel that way. He's always watching over and caring for his people. So the question is to us, right? Do we have an unwavering belief in God's faithfulness? Or are we just like that first generation that ended up perishing? Verse 11, may the Lord, the God of your fathers, increase you to 1,000 times more than you are and bless you just as he has promised you. So Moses wants the numbers to continue. But he said in verse 12, how can I alone endure the burden and weight of you and your strife? Obtain for yourselves men who are wise, discerning, informed from your tribes, and I will appoint them as heads. What he's talking about here is he's retelling the story of Exodus 18, where Jethro observed the camp of Israel and saw that Moses was going to burn himself out. And he advised Moses to basically set up a judiciary branch of the government where these matters would get handled and then the more difficult matters would get escalated up. And so guess what, right? Look at this list here. Able men who fear God, men of truth, who hate dishonest gain. And guess what? God still wants those attributes there because we see in Acts 6, brothers and sisters, select from among you those with good reputation, full of the Spirit and of wisdom, whom we may put in charge of the task. So very trustworthy here. Raising up able and honest people is very important in ministry. And we see what happens when any of these attributes fail, right? We have someone with a bad reputation, someone who's not full of the Spirit, not full of wisdom. We see things falling apart here. So a good reputation would really align to people of integrity who hate dishonest gain back in what Jethro was talking about. Full of the Spirit would be people who fear God. Full of wisdom would be people of truth who are able to discern right from wrong. And these are very important for all of us as disciples and working in ministry. Verse 14, and you answered me and said, the thing which you have said to do is good. So I took the heads of your tribes. And again, these people didn't have any say in this. The one people he's talking to, he's talking about the previous generation. Wise and informed men, and appointed them as heads over you, commanders of thousands, hundreds, fifties, tens, and officers for your tribes. 16, then I ordered your judges at this time, saying, here are the cases between your fellow countrymen, and judge righteously between a person and his fellow countrymen or the stranger who was with him. So justice is supposed to be blind, impartiality without fear. Jesus will talk about judging with a righteous judgment. We'll look at that next. You are to not to show partiality in judgment. You are not to be afraid of any person, for the judgment is God's. The case that is too difficult to you, basically escalate it, and I will hear it. So Moses wants his audience to hear this ordination speech because these qualities are still needed and necessary. when he talks about righteous judgment, this reminded me of a passage we just covered on our Wednesday night series. Do not judge by the outward appearance, but judge with a righteous judgment. And this sounds like basically judging fairly. You know, don't let the innocent go free. Don't let the guilty go free and don't convict the innocent. But really, it goes deeper than that. Judging here with a righteous judgment is in the interest of overall righteousness. And so we know from our system, a parallel might be someone who truly did commit the crime. To judge fairly means that person should be found guilty. But if the accused constitutional rights were violated in any manner, then in the interest of overall righteousness, that means we find him not guilty. And so that's how that works there. Those who lead God's people must be devoted to overall righteousness and not just the, you know, think about the impact of this decision and what it's going to cause, maybe the precedent that it will set, to use a legal term. So impartial and without prejudice, that's the big thing here. This is why Lady Justice, which you see the statue, she's always pictured as blind, because it doesn't matter who's bringing the case, or at least it shouldn't. That's, you know, kind of the difference between the way it should be and reality is something to think about here. James 2:9, if you show partiality, you are committing sin and are convicted by the law as violators. Leviticus 19, you shall not do injustice in judgment, not show partiality to the poor, nor give preference to the great. So it doesn't matter if they can't afford a lawyer, you don't look down on them, but you also don't give them any special treatment either. You treat everyone fairly. You are to judge your neighbor fairly. Note in Deuteronomy, it also says the neighbor and the stranger. Don't do these things just for people in your community. Do them for everyone. We have the story of the Good Samaritan who are we supposed to give justice to? Well, it's the person who's least like us, the person who stands against us. And the old line, the way it used to be, is I may not agree with what you say, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. Now, we see that eroding in our day, but in a sense, that's how we're supposed to look at things. We're supposed to have equality and a one-tiered justice system. We hear a lot about a two-tiered justice system today. One system for the rich and powerful, and another for those who maybe can't afford the best lawyers. How we arrive at our judgment of others matters. Opening his mouth, Peter said, I most certainly understand now that God is not one to show partiality. This is not just talking about a courtroom, even though that's very important. It's talking about how we treat each other as well. And it took a moment for Peter to figure what not showing partiality meant. And he finally got there in Acts chapter 10. Matthew 22, teacher, we know that you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and do not care what anyone thinks. You are not partial to anyone. Jesus, of course, sets the standard that we are to follow. And then pragmatically, we want to judge righteously and impartially because, well, it's just in our best interest to do so. For the way you judge, you will be judged. And by your standard of measure, it will be measured back to you. So let us be impartial and then we can expect being treated impartially. On the subject of justice, we're going to get into some very tough passages in Deuteronomy where it reads as if God is telling the Israelites to kill every man, woman, and child that they find in Canaan. And a lot of people stumble over this. A lot of people don't like it. And a lot of people, you know, they reject the whole Bible because of that. How could a just God advocate looks to be genocide? Now, firstly, once we get there, we'll look at the Hebrew underlying. And it may not mean what we think it means. But even if it does, we still have to rely on God's righteous judgment. We get a clue on this judgment from Genesis 15. The wrongdoing of the Amorite is not yet complete. You have to study the Canaanite and the Amorite worldview. It was a death cult, basically. Many gods, and especially El and Baal, they had female goddesses abound. Many high places, they were sexually very immoral, and possibly Moloch cults, which were human sacrifice, burning your babies alive, are evidence. So very, very wicked. And so we may not have all the facts, we can't judge something unless we have all the facts. And so this is God's purview. God sees everything. But we still take it on faith that God's judgments are just. And that's the question. It's a challenge for us. Do we believe that God is just? Do we trust him even when we don't understand him? Will we be obedient enough to do something he asks us to do even if we don't understand it? Or even worse, say we do understand it but don't agree with it. He's still asking us to do it. And so that's the true definition of not my will be done, but your will be done. Verse 19, we set out from Horeb and went through that great and terrible wilderness that you saw on the way to the hill country of the Amorites, just as the Lord our God commanded us. We came to Kadesh Barnea, and I said to you, you have come to the hill country of the Amorites, which the Lord our God is about to give us. See, the Lord your God has placed in the land, has placed the land before you. Go up, take possession, just as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has spoken to you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. So already we've had a couple do not fear references here. The next event Moses is going to talk about is that big failure, the incident where the 12 spies were sent to the promised land. Even though God promised them victory, they faithlessly and fearfully refused to claim that victory. Moses is going to recap it here. It's like they're watching a game film of the first half. And so the coach is at halftime telling the team how bad things were, but the game is not over yet. But to set up that we can do better, we have to set up how, discuss how we failed here. 22. Then all of you approached me and said, let us send men ahead of us so that we may spy out the land for us and bring us back word by the way which we should go up and the cities which we should enter. The plan pleased me, and I took 12 of your men, one from each tribe, and they turned and went up into the hill country and came to the valley of Eshcol. That's one of those valleys in the Shephelah, and spied it out. And they took some of the fruit of the land and brought it down to us. They brought us a report saying, the land that the Lord our God is about to give us is Tov. It's good. This is the first of several references to the word Tov, to the land in Deuteronomy. The Lord is a giver of good things. Now, the valley here, this is the story where they went and they found grape bunches that they had to bring on tie between poles because they were so huge, so very much abundant. Yet you were unwilling to go up. Instead, you rebelled against the command of the Lord, and you grumbled in your tents and said, because the Lord hates us, ouch, he has brought us out of the land of Egypt to hand us over to the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brothers have made their hearts melt by saying, the people are bigger than taller than we, the cities are large and fortified to heaven, and besides, we saw the sons of Anakim there, the giants are in the land. They rejected God's gift. God had promised them that they were going to have victory over this, but they let their fear get in the way, and they even blasphemed, right? The Lord hates us. If you're a parent of a child that's, you know, over 12, you may have had that child tell you, I hate you. And you know it's just an emotional reaction. They're not getting their way, and so they lash out. But there really aren't any words to describe the pain of a parent when you hear that statement. Now think about how God felt, right, when his people said this. When we reject him, guess what? It's the same thing. We may not use these words, but our actions are saying, we don't trust you. I can do my way better. I don't think you have my best interests in mind. And so it's a sense of rejection here. Verse 29, but I said to you, do not be terrified nor fear them. The Lord your God who goes before you will himself fight for you, just as he did for you in Egypt before your eyes. You all lived to see this miraculous exodus, this miraculous deliverance, and now you think he's just brought you out and you're going to die? In the wilderness where you saw how the Lord your God carried you, just as a man carries his son on all the road which you have walked until you come to this place. Yet in spite of this, you did not trust the Lord our God, who goes before you on your way, to seek out a place for you, to make a camp in the fire by night, to show you the way which you should go, and in the cloud by day. Now, the fire by night, it was interesting because this is the desert, right? If you know anything about desert climates, it can be a little chilly at night, so the fire would keep you warm. It can also be very hot during the day, so the cloud would keep the sun on you. So God is just protecting and providing for them every step of the way. And yet, they have this doubt. And again, look in the mirror. How much do we doubt? Depending on, you know, we've been given a lot, but yet we still doubt from time to time. Now the Lord heard the sound of your words, and he was angry and swore an oath, saying, none of these men, this evil generation, shall see the good land which I swore to give them. Good land again. Except Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, he shall see it, and to him I will give the land on which he has set foot, and to his sons, because he has followed the Lord fully. We all want to be like Caleb. We get this impression that the God of the Old Testament is angry and vengeful, while the God of the New Testament is love and grace. Now, of course, it is true that there is a lot of judgment and that type of wording coming from the Old Testament. But however, God doesn't change. There are plenty of times where Jesus gets angry and has some sharp words to say to those who are against him. So maybe when someone says the God of the Old Testament is angry, our response should be, is that a bad thing? Because God gets angry at ingratitude. He gets angry against slander. He gets angry at mistreatment of the poor, and especially he gets angry when his people are falling into spiritual adultery, which is called idolatry. Despite all of this, the Hebrew Bible says that God is slow to anger, including Numbers 14, talking about this very episode at Kadesh Barnea. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in mercy. Back to Deuteronomy 1:37, the Lord was angry with me also on your account, saying, not even you shall enter there. Joshua, the son of Nun, who stands before you, shall himself enter there. Encourage him, for he will give it to Israel as an inheritance. And we're going to see this handoff from Moses to Joshua a little bit later in the book. Moses here is injecting a different time where he was told to speak to the water to have water gush forth, but he lost his cool. And again, this is out of time sequence, but that Eastern mindset doesn't need things to be literally chronological. He's making a point here. And so whereas our mindset would say, hey, this is what's going on here. This is wrong. Not necessarily an error in the Eastern mindset. This is coming from Numbers 20, and Moses was told to speak to the rock, and yet he gets angry with them. Listen now, hear now, you rebels. Shall we bring water for you out of this rock? And Moses raised his hand and struck the rock twice, and then water came out, and they drank. But, verse 12 of Numbers 20, the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, since you did not trust in me to treat me as holy in the sight of the sons of Israel, for that reason you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. Commentators have pointed out at least two things that Moses did wrong here. First and foremost, he was God's agent and God's ambassador. He misrepresented God here, and God calls him out for it. If Moses is mad at the people, then they're going to assume that God is mad at them. Well, God wasn't mad at them. And so for that misrepresentation, Moses was punished. It's a big and painful lesson to learn here. So first and foremost, how we act is how people see the Lord. And so if we're an ambassador for Jesus, we've got to reflect that. And our behavior and our habits, all of that reflects on how others see the Lord. And so that's a big lesson for us. The second way he messed up is kind of interesting, because when you look at 1 Corinthians, Paul tells us that this rock that Moses had just struck was Jesus. The spiritual rock which followed them was Jesus. So typologically, Moses broke the model in a sense, because remember, the rock is Jesus. There was a time before where God said, strike the rock and water will come out. This time God said, speak to the rock and water come out. Moses doesn't obey. He strikes the rock how many times? Twice. And then water still came out. But the thought is that Moses broke the model, because Jesus is only struck and crucified once, not twice. And so he was misrepresenting God of the big thing, but he also kind of messed up this model, because God wanted this rock to be Christ. So anyway, kind of fun to think about. We've talked in other lessons about the proximity principle. So obviously the bigger problem here is his misrepresentation as an ambassador of God. At this time, Moses was God's representative and bore the greatest responsibility to represent him faithfully. So his punishment was in direct proportion to what God rightfully expected of him. And that's from the Apologetic Study Bible. There are many other applications for us, right? God asks us for obedience and we let him down. But this time, Moses was the rebel, and it cost him. Verse 39, moreover, your little ones who you said would become plunder, and your sons who this day have no knowledge of good and evil, that's a fascinating aside there, shall enter there, and I will give it to them, and they shall take possession of it. But as for you, turn around and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea. So again, this is that first generation. They were sentenced to walk a total of 40 years in the wilderness, instead of inherit, and anyone under 20 was anyone over 20 was not going to survive to this day. So Moses is talking now to that second generation, whom back 40 years ago Moses said they have no knowledge of good and evil. And that's a fascinating statement, and obviously clearly a reference to the Garden of Eden. And remember, in the intro video we talked about the land being in some sense a type of the Garden of Eden, that restoration back to the way things were supposed to be. A taste of the kingdom in this age is another way to look at it. So the land is that for the people. It was supposed to be that. That's what God intended. But we have to be faithful. And we await the fulfillment in the age to come, but we get a taste of it here and now. And it's the same with us. It's the same with what God has given us here when Jesus says the kingdom is here. So the second generation will claim by faith what their fathers couldn't take by force. This is yet another of the many examples in the Old Testament where the first item in a pair is despised, smitten, or rejected, while the second one is loved and accepted. So here we see they failed to take the land the first time, but they will inherit it the second time. The sons of Abraham and Isaac, right? The first one was rejected. Ishmael and Esau, right? And it was Isaac and Jacob who were accepted. Moses tried to deliver the people twice. The first time he failed, the second time he accepted. Striking the rock and speaking to the rock, which was supposed to be that model. The first two kings of Israel, right? We have Saul rejected and David accepted. And then we believe the two comings of Messiah, right? Fit this model also. Despised, smitten, and rejected the first time, coming in glory the second time. Verse 43, so I spoke to you, but verse 41, sorry, then you replied to me, we have sinned against the Lord. We ourselves will go up and fight just as the Lord commanded us. And every man of you strapped his weapons of war, and you viewed it easy to go into the hill country. But the Lord said to me, say to them, do not go up, do not fight, for I am not with you, otherwise you will be defeated by your enemies. So just like we do, they immediately tried to cover up their sin as if it never happened. Are you seeing all the lessons for us in this book? And we're only in chapter one. The people feigned remorse, but it was definitely a case of my will be done, not your will. Now, verse 43, so I spoke to you, but you would not listen. Instead, you rebelled against the command of the Lord, acted presumptuously, and went up into the hill country. And the Amorites who lived in that hill country came out against you and chased you as bees do, and they scattered you from Seir to Hormah. So they were just kind of wiped all over the desert in this battle here. Hormah is thought to be 7.5 miles east of Beersheba, and the whole region from Seir to Hormah, Seir is in Edom, is about 50 miles. So this is all nomad country. God's timing is perfect, and they blew it. If we miss an opportunity, very rarely will God allow us in our flesh to go back and reclaim it. We do have this thought of God as a God of second chances, but there are consequences too. My wife has a friend who says, you can't go back and reclaim yesterday's manna. And this is referring to another time in the wilderness where the generation was disobedient. You know, God provided manna in the wilderness to keep them nourished. But he said, you only get one pot of manna per day. And you don't try and hoard it. Don't try and save up for tomorrow because it will be rotten and spoiled with worms the next day. And so you can't go back to yesterday's manna. If you missed it, you missed it. The writer to the Hebrews will reference this failure at Kadesh Barnea. It's really a big moment in early Israelite history, not one to be proud of. Today, if you hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the day of provocation. And he's talking about this. So go back and read Hebrews chapter 3. Verse 45, then you returned to wet before the Lord. Now you're sorry, right? But the Lord did not listen to your voice nor pay attention to you. So you remained at Kadesh for many days. And this ends mid-sentence in Hebrew. It's a very strange place to put a chapter break, but that's where we have it. A lot of the translations will try and finish the sentence so it doesn't just hang there, but it's supposed to be after you remained at Kadesh for many days, and then verse 1 of chapter 2, then we turned and set out for the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spoke to me, and we circled Mount Seir for many days. So this is, again, talking about the wanderings. So back to, they felt remorse and God hid his face, and we wonder why. Doesn't God always hear us? But there's a definite cause and effect here. God is not obliged to hear the prayers of those who approach him with unrepentant hearts. Jesus says this, if you have a broken relationship, go mend that relationship, reconcile, and then come bring your gift to the altar. So a lesson there. Remember our earlier comments about the mindset of the Middle Eastern, how they would see them as being there for these failures. They would say that our people's successes are our successes. So the things that happened before, we took part in that. Also, their failures are also our failures. And so our Western mindset rejects this. We want to say what's past is past. You know, not entirely true. What the writer to the Hebrews said is, today, do not harden your hearts, just like you did 3,000 years ago. And we talked about that quote from Moshe, who in Jerusalem, who says, there aren't any 30-year-old Israelis or Palestinians. Everyone here is 3,000 years old, because they all have this deep connection to the past. A good quote and a good way to think about this as we close out here, like a river, which is constantly being made up of new molecules of water, yet is always the same river, so a people retains its identity, even though its individual members are constantly changing over time. That's Richard Elliot Friedman. And Paul actually used a tree reference to say that we as Gentile believers have been grafted in to that tree of Israel. We could easily say that our stream has been, you know, diverted into the flowing river that is Israel. So their stories are now our stories. So don't think that this happened like all these years ago and it has no relevance to us. Picture yourself sitting on the east side of the Jordan, listening to Moses, because that's the way the Eastern mindset would. Hey, we were there. This happened to us. These are our people too. In chapter 2, Moses will move on from that first generation, speak directly to that current generation that's ready to inherit. So we'll get to that next time along the Talmudim Way.